One of the biggest acts in rock and roll releases its 9th studio album this weekend, and the musicians are doing it all by themselves. Pearl Jam has long held a famously anti-corporate stance. NPR's Netta Ulaby has this story on the band's new twist on do-it-yourself capitalism.
Backspacer is Pearl Jam's first major album since the band became free agents, finally fulfilling a 7-record contract with Sony. In this, the opening song, they sound psyched. Escaping the contract with Sony took the band 15 years.
They were shockingly bad in terms of the nature of those kind of deals are so bad because, you know, they have you for 7 records but can drop you at any time.
Stone Gossard helped found Pearl Jam way back in 1990 when Seattle's vaunted grunge scene first became a marketable commodity. Since then, the band has sold over 60 million albums. Gossard says the musicians' share was pitiful.
We've made our money touring. I mean, that's how we've made our money.
They have made, rather, a lot of it. Now, after seeing the bulk of their record sales go back to the label, Pearl Jam is experimenting with self-distribution. Here's what they came up with. You can buy Backspacer on the Pearl Jam website, at iTunes, on Xbox's Rock Band game, as a Verizon ringtone, or at Target.
The center of it was this deal with Target. Of the last 3 records, I don't think we sold 1 million records, so they went ahead and bought 1 million records right off the bat. So that was a pretty enticing deal.
Some fans were startled by this partnership. They remember how the band used to rail against corporate interests, tearing down ad banners at concerts, and fighting a losing battle with Ticketmaster over service charges. So Pearl Jam made a point of getting Target to agree that some 800 independent record stores could also sell Backspacer. Jim DeRogatis is a rock critic for the Chicago Sun-Times.
I think it's neat, both for Pearl Jam and Target, that they've made a deal like this that isn't going to exclude the corner record store where so many of us first fell in love with music like Pearl Jam's.
Pearl Jam, says DeRogatis, is in a unique place in that it's able to patch together a deal like this.
Major labels are no longer of much use to bands of a certain level. Pearl Jam, Nine Inch Nails, Radiohead. They can be their own corporation selling directly to the retailers that they choose to deal with.
The record companies are just sort of getting cut out. It's basically what's happening at this point.
Stone Gossard admits that most bands could never in a million years hope for this kind of deal. For them, MySpace is the best way for their music to get heard. Backspacer is off to a strong start. Its first single was iTunes' top new song when it was released last month. It's called The Fixer.
It's a poppier, more upbeat song.
Jim DeRogatis of the Chicago Sun-Times.
It's about fixing things. He's going to fix things, or somebody's going to fix things. And I don't think they're going to fix the record industry for sure, but it is neat to see them not doing business as usual. A lot of other bands of their stature are still caving.
The experiment may not work, but Pearl Jam says they hope they'll learn enough to get a better sense of how to release their next album. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Ricky Skeggs, do you remember a time when you were not holding a string instrument in your hands?
barely.
Your love is colder than a foggy river flowing o'er a heart of stone.
Ricky Skaggs has been making music for 50 years now. He played with bluegrass great Ralph Stanley when he was still in his teens, went on to have a streak of country hits, then went back to bluegrass, and now he's returned to the songs he learned from his father as a young boy in eastern Kentucky. Ricky Skaggs is solo on his new CD, Songs My Dad Loved, doing all the vocals and playing all the instruments, fiddles, banjo, piano, lots more.
My dad bought a mandolin for me when I was five. He came in, he was a construction welder, and so he traveled quite a bit. And came in one Saturday morning, and this little mandolin was in my bed when I woke up.
In your bed with
in
you?
In the bed. And so I woke up and opened it up and looked in there, and there was this little teeny tiny mandolin, and I just fell in love with wood and strings. It's like the greatest gift I could have gotten. So he showed me three chords, G, C, and D, the basic Mel Bay way, you know. And so that was it. And then he got snowed in at a job up in Lima, Ohio, and couldn't get home for a couple of weeks. And so when he came back home, I was singing and changing keys and playing and all that. And it just really... it's really got him so excited. He went out and bought a guitar. You know, he didn't even have a guitar in the house at the time.
So he knew that, if Ricky's interested, I better pick up the guitar
again.
That's
right.
What do you think inspired him to buy you that first mandolin when you were 5 years old?
Well, there was a real reason. He and my uncle, his brother got killed in World War II, and they had a little brother's duet when they were about 15, 16 years old, and they played just locally. You know, they never traveled and went anywhere, but they played and sang together. My dad played guitar and sang lead, and my uncle played mandolin and sung tenor. And when he passed away, boy, my dad just, it was a real blow to my father, you know, because that was not only his real blood brother, but his singing partner, you know. And my dad just kind of made one of those inner vows, I think, that if I ever have a son that shows, you know, any kind of, you know, interest in music, I'm going to buy him a mandolin. He had a purpose in his heart that he wanted me to play the mandolin.
Ricky, I want to do a little audio time travel with you here.
Come back over here just a minute. Let's tell all these folks your name. You want to tell them? All right.
My name's Ricky Skaggs.
Ricky Skaggs. And you're how old?
7 years old.
7 years old. You're originally from up about Louisa, Kentucky.
Ricky, that takes you back. That's you on the Flatt and Scruggs TV show. That's you with Lester Flatt.
Yep.
He gets a little excited. He calls you Ricky Skraggs.
Yes,
maybe
he
thinking
does.
About his pal Earl Scruggs there.
Scraggs and Scruggs.
And you're up there. We should describe this. You're up there. You've got a little string tie on. Your hair slicked back. You're probably elbow high, and you've got your mandolin, and you look scared to death.
I was confident, though. I might have looked scared, but I knew what I was supposed to do.
And you come back. Later in the show, and you sing
"Ruby." Are you mad at your man at 7 years old?
Let's listen.
Thank you so much, and you hurry back.
I wish I could sing that high again. Can't quite get up to those notes anymore, but that's almost 50 years ago.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe. When you listen to those things, they really, really take you back. And here again, you know, we're talking about my dad. He's the center of this thing. He's the one that made this happen, you know.
What did he do?
Well, he just had this knack for knowing where to be at the right place at the right time. I mean, he he just had he had a quality about him that he was so confident as a person. He knew who he was, but he was such a friendly person. He's always had his hand out. Hi, I'm Hobart Skaggs, you know, and this is my boy Ricky, you know, and he had made friends with the backstage guard at the Opry, and when it was down at the old Ryman downtown
in Nashville.
Yeah, in Nashville, and Mr. Bell was the backstage guard, and so he had made friends with him somehow. I don't know if they traded pocket knives or exactly what they did, but anyway, they let me backstage, and I was back there. Me and my dad, you know, was back there just kind of playing. I had my mandolin out, and I was playing something, and Earl Scruggs walks by. Said, "That's your boy?" "Yes, sir, it is." And "Well, why don't you? He's really good. Why don't you bring him down for an audition for our television show next week?" And that's how it happened.
The new CD with these songs from your father, on the songs where you're singing close harmony with yourself,
yeah.
Say, "What is a home without love?"
Yeah.
Would you be hearing your dad's voice as you were doing
this? Oh, yes.
That?
What is home without a baby?
He was a really great singer and guitar player, and he could have gone on probably and been, you know, a known singer, you know, and could have made records and stuff. But he knew that if he did, he would have to leave the family to do it.
To kiss you each night at the door.
Now, Ricky, if you were singing this with your dad, he'd have the bottom part, you'd be
yeah.
up. And that's the third.
It's a third, yeah. Actually, the third, and if you'll listen right through here, this is the old Monroe style.
You may have wealth and its pleasure, but what is...
Where they come together. Isn't that the coolest thing? You know, nobody sings like that anymore. You know, that's just so mountain and so cool. You know, I love that. And so I really wanted this generation to kind of hear that.
Ricky Skaggs, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Melissa. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
He is your friend. He is your friend. He holds the future in his hand.
And you can hear songs from Ricky Skaggs' new solo album, Songs My Dad Loved, at nprmusic.org.
That while on earth we roam, whate'er may come, he bends above to guide his children safely home. God holds the future in his hands, and every heart he understands.
He understands.
On him depends.
On him depends.
He is your friend.
He is your friend.
He holds the future in his hands.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You've probably already heard plenty about the reissue of the Beatles' entire catalog and the release of the new Rock Band video game. Well, our friend Jim Nader has even more Beatles music, but without John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Jim Nader, the Fab Uno, is, of course, the host of the Annoying Music Show on Chicago Public Radio, which is syndicated to dozens of prison systems across the country. He joins us from their studios at WBEZ. Jim, how are you?
Scott, as always, when I'm on your show, I feel as lonely as Eleanor Rigby. I just put my face in a jar
that you keep by the door. I was about to say that myself.
Who is it for, Scott? Who is it for?
All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? But listen, I'm glad you raised that question because it's tough enough for a good singer to do a cover, as it's called, for another song that somebody's made popular. But it's got to be particularly tough for someone to do a re-recording of a Beatles song.
Absolutely. All kinds of artists have done their own versions of the Beatles. Tom Jones, even Elvis Presley. But this next song is not by Tom or Elvis.
Hey, Juice, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey, Juice, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better.
That version of Hey Jude by the great Tiny Tim from a great CD.
This is Tiny Tim?
Yeah, a great CD called Girl when he combined with Brave Combo. And who thought of doing it as a cha-cha? We love him here at the Annoying Music Show.
Mashups have become popular in recent years, right? Singer-DJ mixes two different songs to form a new track?
Absolutely, and with the remastering of the Beatles' library, as you said, getting such great acclaim, you would think every Beatles song is on there, but we think they left one out. It's by Alan Copeland, who will never be confused with Aaron Copeland.
Mission Impossible theme, right?
Once I had a girl, or should I say, once she had me.
Wrong.
Yes. Now, Jim, let me understand. This is not like two Yale students just cutting up with a laptop. This was recorded by professional musicians who were trying to sell something?
This was recorded in 1969, Alan Copeland Singers. You can laugh all you want. But 40 years ago, this won a Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Pop Paranoid Schizophrenic Arrangement. That's true. Part of
one of my favorite
the
categories. Yeah, the Grammy part is it.
And people were upset because when they bought it, 5 seconds after they played it, the tape self-destructed. Little Mission Impossible humor.
Couldn't get their money back, could they, come to think of it? Yeah. All right. Now, I remember the first time a few years ago. In the elevator, I heard a Bob Dylan song. And there was a part of me that thought he didn't grow up in Hibbing, Minnesota, thinking, oh, someday they're going to be playing my music in elevators all over the world. Now, that's happened to the Beatles for years now, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a catch-22. It's, oh, the cash, but then, oh, the humanity.
Something the way she attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me, I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how.
That's the great Telly Savalas, of course.
Telly Savalas?
Mm-hmm. And admit it, you
liked
it. Did
that Telly Savalas?
Admit it, you liked it, those guys.
I did. I was always a big Telly Savalas. Telly Savalas, you know, the only way that I know that he once recorded an album as music is because he has figured into your little your little Bayons to music before.
Well, you know, I have some of his songs, but we all know you have the definitive Telly Savalas Sings anthology. Scott, do you mind if I go off script just for a moment?
No, I've been looking forward to it.
As you know, it was just a few years ago when I was privileged to make it past security in a 10-year wedding. And I was not surprised at the beauty of Caroline, your French bride, but was surprised at how beautifully she sang. Remember that Beatles tune she sang for you at your wedding? Well, I taped it. I think it's telling that Caroline chose Help as your wedding song.
Sacrament. Ed, you know, I want you to know, both of our daughters have inherited her beautiful singing voice.
That's actually the great French singer Mimi Saint-Ange. I apologize to Caroline. She sounds nothing like that.
No.
She's actually much worse. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
My wife does everything beautifully.
No.
She's too young to remember the Beatles when they were the Beatles, but anybody, even my wife's age, has grown up listening to the Beatles.
And it's not just in America, of course, or Britain. It's around the world. Play this version backwards. It says, Paul has the swine flu. Paul has the swine flu. Try it. Well, people don't have turntables, so it's hard to do that.
No, I know. We'll figure out a way. We'll come to our website. We'll do it for you. I understand we have one last clip. Is that correct?
Well, yes. We thought we could prove our theory that the best annoying music is produced when two great forms of music are combined. creates music so annoying it's actually dangerous, and Miss Kathy Berberian demonstrates this.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. Then I'll say the something. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. Oh, dear.
Is this serious?
Yes, Kathy Berberian in the 1960s did operatic versions of contemporary songs, and luckily for the Annoying Music Show, she chose the Beatles.
Oh, my word. But she's really trying there. I mean, she has obviously an exquisite voice.
Well, and that's the beauty of the best annoying music. It's when it's a serious attempt for whatever reason, you know it when you hear it, when it just goes awry, much like your show. That's off the record, though.
Well, Jim, I'd love to say that it's lovely to talk to you, but...
You lie!
That would be... Thank you. Well, that's our friend Jim Nader, who hosts the Annoying Music Show on Chicago Public Radio, which is carried by scores of public radio stations across the country who've lost all sense of self-esteem. Jim, nice talking to you.
I'm glad someone had a good time. Same to you, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand.
Last night, the New York Philharmonic introduced its new music director. Alan Gilbert is the first person actually born and raised in New York to hold the post, and he follows such luminaries as Gustav Mahler and Leonard Bernstein. Still, the shoes he's stepping into are already comfortable for him. Alan Gilbert literally grew up with the Philharmonic. His parents played in the violin section, and his mother still does. Jeff London has the story.
Some of Alan Gilbert's most cherished memories of his childhood are of hanging out where his parents worked.
I was always excited to be around the orchestra. I loved going on tour with the orchestra, and people even playing today remember when I was the little orchestra brat.
Now, they call him boss. Anthony Tomasini, chief music critic for the New York Times, says Gilbert's a somewhat surprising choice for the Philharmonic's top post.
Alan Gilbert is 42 and he's young, but he's not flashy. He's a very serious, a little self-effacing, rather shy musician. And yet, I'm convinced that New Yorkers will love those qualities about him, and that his sincerity and his devotion to communicating and to reaching people will really come through.
Communicating to New Yorkers is very much a part of Alan Gilbert's agenda. Yesterday, the Philharmonic opened its final dress rehearsal to the public and broadcast its opening night concert for free on a big screen in Lincoln Center's plaza.
I have the hope and the ambition to make the New York Philharmonic something that all New Yorkers can be aware of and proud of, whether or not they come to concerts. It's a shame when people somehow have the idea that they're not going to be able to appreciate or understand what's happening, because, you know, it's pretty straightforward and pretty accessible what we do, and part of our job is to make sure that people know that we are really there for them.
In a lot of ways, Alan Gilbert represents a tectonic shift for the Philharmonic. Carter Bray is the orchestra's principal cellist and says it's the first time he's worked with a music director who's younger than he is.
I'm relating to him on a generational level in a way I've never related to a music director before. The last two music directors have been from my parents' generation. So I'm relating to Alan as... not as a musical equal, because he's my boss in that sense, but as a generational equal, someone who grew up imbibing the same cultural currents that I did.
And Bray says Gilbert is kind of the anti-maestro.
I'll never forget the day shortly after he was retired that I ran into him in the basement level of Avery Fisher Hall, getting to know the people who work in the IT department. I'd never seen anything like that before. He literally was getting to know the organization from the ground up.
And he's already making decisions that are putting his own stamp on the Philharmonic. Where most orchestras would choose an instrumentalist as their artist in residence, Gilbert chose a singer, baritone Thomas Hampson.
It took me by surprise. My first question is, are you really sure you want a singer to do this right off the bat? He laughed and he said, you know, what I want is a musician who has a whole bunch of different kinds of interests and who likes to talk about them and who can augment the season we'll put together and work into the season that we put together and, you know, building a team. So I said, you know, you're on.
Tis the gift to be simple, tis the gift to be free, tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight.
Hampson will be everywhere this season, performing and touring with the orchestra and talking with audiences. But critic Anthony Tomasini says where audiences will immediately notice a difference is in Alan Gilbert's programming choices.
He started on principle. I am going to begin my tenure with a new piece by our new composer in residence. It's a statement.
That's a little bit of Expo, which Finnish composer Magnus Lindberg wrote for opening night. It's the first time the New York Philharmonic has played a world premiere on opening night since Leonard Bernstein played a new piece by Aaron Copland in 1962. Magnus Lindberg says he was amazed that Alan Gilbert wanted to start the season and his tenure as music director with a new work.
I wanted to do a piece that really would have that opening sort of element in it, so it's like the exposition of his era. It's a new epoch. It's a virtuoso piece, plenty of noise and plenty of music.
Plenty of music is what Alan Gilbert wants to give New Yorkers. New works right next to masterpieces of the classical repertoire.
Everything we do is to let people experience music in all its glory and in all its variety.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
You can hear more of our interview with Alan Gilbert at nprmusic.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Houston.